Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
Hello, everybody. I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Coming up later in the hour, we are talking with David Biancooley. You know that name. David is going to talk to us about TV game shows and why some of them have been so successful for decades. It is a time of change in the TV game show industry. Of course, we want to hear from you in our middle segment. What's your favorite game show memory? Give us a call. 888-477-9499, or you can email studio2@whyy.org.
Have some fond memories there as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And
maybe we'll get into that.
We will. Also, we're going to talk music. We have some fresh tunes for you coming out of Philly that'll keep your summer evenings jamming. We're going to keep you in the know. I like that. But first, Avi, we're going to dig into some headlines from today. I have the shovel first. And I have some good news.
Okay.
From Atlantic City, two casino success stories following years of failures. If you recall, the former Trump Taj Mahal and Revel casinos closed and reopened under new management as Hard Rock and the Ocean Casino Resort. That was about 5 years ago. The shift brought back about 6,000 jobs that had been lost, and locals were very concerned that the mistakes of former investors would be repeated. Well, I'm happy to report that those two casinos are doing extremely well. In fact, they are two of the most successful casinos now in Atlantic City. And when you rank them in terms of money won from in-person gamblers, the Borgata is number one, $724 million won.
Jeez.
Hard Rock, number two, $492 million won. And Ocean was third with $356 million. Pretty good numbers, right?
And one of the growing aspects or parts of the gambling industry in New Jersey is the online gambling, which is legal there. Now, it's legal provisionally. The state legislature needs to basically extend the timeline of legality. And there's a bill that would have originally allowed online casino gambling to run through 2033. And it's been amended to just a 2-year extension. So we're all watching that because that's become a bigger and bigger part of the business. I'm guessing many of you listening know people who do online gambling and sports betting at this point. And so that's something we're watching as well with the future of Atlantic City.
Yeah, I'm excited because I was glad to see that story come out, because you would think that new casinos would take away market share of other casinos, but that wasn't the case here. They've grown overall market share in large part because of the new ways that people can gamble. Yeah. And so this is a success story coming out of AC.
Well, except for the people that lost their money.
I know. Don't even.
Well, yes, I don't know how it is for them, but it is. I mean, that there is a serious aspect to that,
yeah,
which is that gambling has become far more legal, far more prevalent. You see advertisements for it constantly on television, especially if, like me, you watch a lot of sports. And people are certainly worried about the guardrails there, because there is a compulsive nature to many gamblers, and that can lead to some really dire consequences. But it does seem like the business is thriving in AC, and I'm a little surprised, to be honest, because I always assumed that with the proliferation of casinos in other places, that AC would sort of limp to the finish line in terms of its reliance on this. And I guess it's not going that way. So
yeah, which is good for jobs and industries in AC.
Yeah, down the shore, for sure. Well, it can often seem like a gamble, Cherry, when you park your car on the street, because if you're like me, you might have had a catalytic converter stolen. These are, I'm not a car person, but they're attached to your exhaust system. The main thing is that they contain precious metals that people can steal and resell for a lot of money. And there was a big bust announced recently by Bucks County DA Matt Weintraub. This is a catalytic converter theft ring. And disclaimer, above all of this, everything we're about to discuss right now is alleged, because this is just the announcement of the arrest. But they're charging 10 adults and one juvenile in a, what they say is a very large catalytic converter theft ring. At the center of it is a business called TDI Towing in the Port Richmond section of Philadelphia. And they are alleging that between 2020 and 2023, an estimated 27,300 catalytic converters were bought by this business and sold for a total of $8.2 million, which is sort of shocking.
Yeah, it's big business. I mean, and the number of catalytic converter thefts skyrocketed over the past several years. And they are super easy to steal, which is something I learned. You can steal them in like a minute. And people were doing it in broad daylight. And
ours was stolen in broad daylight.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that about your catalytic converter. And
I'm not alone, obviously.
Yeah, and it costs anywhere from $800 to $1,800 to repair the thing. And, I mean, apparently this tow company was allegedly paying thieves $10,000 a night to steal them. That's a lot of money. They were really cranking through this allegedly, and that thieves were coming back multiple times in one night to sell them. So that's how easy they were to steal. So
totally.
Interesting.
I mean,
Big impact case.
I don't know anyone. So the particular car that I own is a hybrid, and everyone that owns the car that I own, they've had this stolen at some point. And of course, the question was like, how do you offload the quote unquote merchandise? Because it's not like anyone could take these in and like extract the metals from them. Someone needs to know how to do that, and they need to take in a lot of them. And apparently, this TDI Towing in Port Richmond was doing the job at scale.
At scale. And since we're talking about court cases, because that's going to be a big criminal court case, we're going to talk about a big Supreme Court case. There was a Supreme Court ruling Tuesday that relates to Pennsylvania and a very unique law here. The Supreme Court narrowly upheld the constitutionality of a law that requires companies that do business in the Commonwealth to consent to being sued in Pennsylvania state court. Yeah. That is, even if the dispute has zero connection to Pennsylvania. The decision, 5-4, Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote the opinion, and it all stemmed from a lawsuit brought by a Norfolk Southern Railway employee who sued the rail company for exposure to cancer-causing toxins. Now, Norfolk Southern is based in Virginia, and the plaintiff in the case is a Virginia resident, and none of the issues or anything that happened.
Yeah, the alleged harm was not in Pennsylvania.
So it's pretty unusual to allow a plaintiff to form shop in this way and to use Pennsylvania courts. And what's really interesting is Pennsylvania is the only state that has a law like this.
Right now, it's the only state that allows it. Yeah, I'm going to nerd out for a second. Fascinating case. So it all has to do with a legal principle called personal jurisdiction, which is what you were referring to. And this case is interesting in many regards. One of the reasons it's interesting is that you noted that Gorsuch wrote the majority opinion, joined by Clarence Thomas, fellow conservative, Samuel Alito, but also Sonia Sotomayor and Ketanji Brown Jackson. Mm-hmm. And so if you know 5-4, on the four, the dissent was written by Amy Coney Barrett, but adjoined by, you know, Kagan, John Roberts, and Brett Kavanaugh. So clearly there are some issues here that don't break along even lines. Also, the principle that they upheld here basically tracks back to a 1917 Supreme Court decision that involved a Philadelphia company involved in a case in Missouri. So the shoe was on the other foot, right? Yeah. So this was something happened in Philly, but the lawsuit was filed in Missouri. So lots of like Philly and local connections here to this specific idea of personal jurisdiction. And we could see other states copy this Pennsylvania law that allows this to happen.
And it's kind of scary, though. It's interesting because it's not easy to sort of like get legal representation in another state that has no connection. You don't know. It's so many questions are raised, like whose law will apply, like all these things. And so definitely will be something to watch in future years.
Yeah, and we might talk a little bit more about what's going on with the Supreme Court later this week. We might get to more of that tomorrow. So if you like this type of nerdery, stick
with us.
We're
going to nerd out on Thursday. Can't wait.
So before we end this segment, we wanted to bring in Mayor Rindy of WHYY's Billy Penn because we want to discuss another court case. Mm-hmm. This involves the New Central Baptist Church in Fittler Square, which is 118 years old. It's at the center of a long-running conflict that reached the Pennsylvania Superior Court. The argument is between the church's pastor and several members of the congregation. Mayor Rindy, who I just mentioned, is here to explain it on Studio 2. Mayor, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So you dug into this thing, and you really dug into this conflict. Give us the lay of the land. Who is in conflict with who and why?
Yeah, so it really got going around 5 years ago, or perhaps even earlier than that. This congregation had hired a pastor, Bernard Reeves. He was there for a few years, and some members started having complaints about him. They said he was doing things that normally elected members of the congregation would do. He supposedly cashed out a certificate of deposit without telling anybody what he was doing with the money. He appointed people to the deacon and trustee boards, and he did some other things, took over different church functions, and people really were not liking him. And so after a lot of back and forth and conflict, they held a meeting. They voted to dismiss him because they had hired mm-hmm. this pastor. And they voted to dismiss him, and he wouldn't leave. And they couldn't really do anything to get him to leave, to stop being their pastor. So they sued him. And the legal battle has been going on for 5 years now.
Wow.
Wow. So let's dig in a bit. Who is this guy, Pastor Bernard Reeves, and how did he get this kind of power?
Well, he's someone who had worked in some other jobs. He'd worked for the post office before. He'd done some pastoring a little bit at another church. And when they needed a pastor, they interviewed him and someone else, and a majority of the congregation picked him. And it seemed like everything was going all right for the first few years, as far as I understand. But eventually, these conflicts came up, and people alleged that he was acting in a dictatorial manner and so forth. And the church has some other problems going on in the background, declining membership and so forth. So it got to be this bad situation over time.
And so what's the bigger picture here about this congregation? Because I understand it's located in an area that's not even gentrified. Clearly, it's sort of teetering on the verge of non-existence. So zoom out a little bit. What drew you to this story beyond just the battle between the two parties?
Yeah, well, certainly a lot of similar churches, Black Baptist churches in Central Philly and South Philly, have closed in recent decades. People are attending church less, and this area near Fittler Square, according to what I read, between 2000 and 2016, it was the most gentrified area of Philadelphia, mm-hmm. in that property values sort of quadrupled during that time. Wow. And there are million-dollar condos all around this old church building. So there are fewer people in the church. The church structure has some issues, and there's development pressure. So it's a delicate situation already. And then you have this conflict, this governance problem within the church. So it is, a delicate situation where some people in the church are worried that this is going to be the end of this more than 100-year-old congregation if the conflict doesn't get resolved.
And I just want to also mention, this church is 118 years old, 3,000 members at it in its heyday, dwindled down to 35. Could you just give us some quick highlights on some of the successes? And now, you know, this it could be teetering out.
Yeah, the church has a very interesting origin story. It started, early in the 20th century as a small church. Then they got a building on Lombard Street, a different building, and they became hugely successful. I read old articles in the Philadelphia Tribune that said it had all the leading, black religious people in the city, or a lot of them, attended this church. It was a huge church. It had all kinds of different functions going on. In the 30s, they started a radio program that was also hugely successful. But over time, fewer and fewer people attended, and it's dwindled down to just a couple dozen now.
Sort of a sad way to go out, if indeed this is the way it ends. That's Mayor Rindy, Billy Penn, investigative reporter. Thanks so much for the time.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Coming up, we're talking game shows with David Bean Cooley. Stick with us on Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm your host, Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
Oh, I love your game show voice. I'm Cherry Gregg. I love it.
Is that yours?
That is mine.
Okay, I liked it.
It's really,
really fine.
Bad.
No. Pat yourself on the back. Well,
yes.
Done.
Well, did you all hear the news that Pat Sajak, the beloved host of Wheel of Fortune, is retiring at the end of the year, and TV personality Ryan Seacrest will be taking over the popular game show? Sajak was a former weatherman and hosted the show for more than 40 years.
And many of you will know that a few years ago, Jeopardy lost its beloved longtime host, Alex Trebek, to cancer. And after trying out a series of replacements, the studio landed on former champ Ken Jennings and actress Mayim Bialik. Both of these programs, Jeopardy and Wheel, are still very popular, but the changes made us think about the future of game shows and about the golden years. Of course, there were shows like What's My Line, the $64,000 question. In fact, the music you just heard was from the $64,000 question theme.
Yes. And so, Avi, today we're talking about what makes a good game show and if people are still tuning in. David Biancooley, TV critic and professor of television studies at Rowan University, is with us. David, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, I love your quiz show voices. They're perfect.
Oh my gosh! So you'll be if we ever host a show, David, you will write a positive review about our program, I assume.
That's got to happen. Yeah, the thing. Imagine having that job for 40 years.
Yes,
I know.
Where all you're doing is making people happy for the most part. And you record a whole week's worth of shows in one day.
And get paid a lot.
And, you get paid a lot when those things hit. You do. There's an awful lot of money to be made there.
And we want to invite our listeners to tune in and to chat with us. Do you have a favorite game show? Share your thoughts. Or favorite game show memory, like with your grandparents, the kids, whatever. Call Studio 2. The number is 888-477-9499. Or you can email studio2@whyy.org. So, David, I want to start by laying the foundation. So just so we know what we're talking about, what exactly is a game show? Just describe the parameters for us.
Well, there's sort of different subgenres. If you're thinking of it as nature, there's there's a game show, there's a quiz show, there's a panel show, but they're all sort of lumped in. But the quiz shows are the ones where you actually have to have a modicum of knowledge in order to advance. Who Wants to Be a Millionaire is a quiz show of the modern era. Certainly $64,000 question is one from the old days. And then you think of shows like, remember Deal or No Deal, where you just had to pick a number, you know, and is the suitcase empty or not empty? I mean, really, household pets could play that game just as well as human contestants. All you're doing is like, over there, that one, you know. There's no skill involved in that. And then there are game shows like Beat the Clock back in the dawn of television, where you had to bounce a ball X number of times within a minute and put it into a cup. And that's all part of a different kind of game show. The panel shows are the ones where most of what was interesting was just the interplay among the various people on the panel, or sometimes it was just the interplay among the host and the guest, like when Groucho Marx guested, you know, You Bet Your Life. In those things, the overall prize money was like $100, $50. It wasn't for the money, it was for the entertainment. So that's a sub-variant. But then you get, you know, $64,000 question or $100,000 pyramid, and that's serious money.
Actually, we're going to play a clip of this is Groucho Marx as a guest panelist on What's My Line, the show where celebrities on the panel try to guess the professions of contestants.
Forced to come into more contact with one sex than the other, and
you realize that no one's listening to you.
Yes, I know. Groucho, I was kind of hoping that was true.
And we're not getting anywhere, sir.
Great timing, as always, from Groucho. David, what is the appeal? You think the basic appeal of the game show to the audience and to the studios that make them?
Good question. To the audience, it's the same appeal as most reality shows. It's a way to get onto television while being a normal or a regular person. Yeah. I won't say normal, but you know, you can get on TV if you're a cab driver and you know an awful lot about a particular subject. And so that's very exciting. Or if you can work your way onto Jeopardy, you get a chance. For the producers, for the people who make these programs, it's the same thing as with reality shows. They're ridiculously cheap to make. You can make a lot of them at one shot. And if they become popular, they are money machines. You know, King Feature, you know, the people who make Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune don't have to do anything else. You know, that's their work day. There's plenty of money coming in.
Yeah, I want to bring in a caller who has a cool memory. Keith from New Jersey has a story about his finding his dad. Go ahead.
Hi, folks. Always nice to hear from you. Also, it's nice to hear and read David's work. My name is Keith, live in Jersey, and I never knew my father at all except for a couple of hints from my mom. They only lasted 6 months. 6 years ago, I'm fiddling around in a couple of extra minutes that you have on a rainy afternoon, a couple of keywords into Google. I found my father for the first time walking, talking as a contestant on To Tell the Truth, October 1961.
Wow.
That led me to find
That's amazing.
I found out about a sociopathic life, 7 marriages, 6 wives, 8 other siblings. My grandfather was a reporter murdered by a dirty cop in Texas in 49. But
wow.
Stemming from this one rainy afternoon, finding my dad on To Tell the Truth.
Well, so that's fascinating. Thank you so much for the call.
What was he pretending to be? What was he pretending to be on To Tell the Truth?
He was the key player. He was a controversial deep sea diver. He'd been taken to task in Newsweek magazine for bringing a body up out of a German sub a couple of years before that. Now we had a big plot to go down to a freighter and bring up treasure. He was the real deal. 2 other people were the pretenders trying to be him.
Wow. So first
Johnny
of all,
Johnny Carson was on the panel before anybody knew who Johnny Carson was.
Wow. So thank you for the call, Keith. I think that call will go in the Studio 2 Hall of Fame. But David, I think it gets back to what you were talking about earlier about the appeal of these shows. The idea that an everyman can be on television and be the star of a show, we do kind of connect with that.
And it wasn't that common, certainly back in the 50s and 60s, because there were fewer programs, more gatekeepers, and fewer ways to get in. Most shows were scripted. And so it was one of the only ways. And just like with programs like American Idol and Survivor and the modern shows where you're competing, back in the days of $64,000 Question and programs like that and 21, you would show up on multiple weeks if you kept winning. You know, you would risk more and return. And people really got to like you and root for you.
You became a character.
And it was that same sort of appeal. Exactly.
Well, if you are just tuning in, we're talking about the history and love of game shows here in America with our guest, David Bean Cooley, TV critic and professor of television studies at Rowan University. We'd love to hear from you. We've had a great caller so far. If you want to share your stories about game shows or your memories, call us 888-477-9499. You can also email us at studio2@whyy.org. And so I want to set up another clip here from a game. This is from a 1958 episode of the $64,000 Question. Virgil Earp, the nephew of Wyatt Earp, was asked multiple three-part questions. Take a listen.
Right, Virgil, we'll start with the question concerning the map. Now, what is the name of the famous trail?
That's the Chisholm Trail.
That is correct. What purpose did it serve?
It served to run the Longhorns to the shipping market on the railroad.
From the Longhorns from where?
From the panhandle of Texas.
That is correct. In what town did it originally end?
Why, it ended in Abilene on the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad.
That is correct. Why did it end there?
Well,
and I have to say that you, this is Mr. Virgil here, and very, very intelligent.
Impressive,
I had to ask,
yes.
Very impressive. And so my question for you, David, is sort of about the contestants. You know, these are every man typically, or every woman typically. What makes a good contestant that makes folks want to tune in?
They really do know their stuff. And it's amazing that when you get to the part where the quiz show scandals, why these shows disappeared in the late 50s, is because some of the producers of some of the shows, in order to make them more exciting, wanted to get rid of some contestants who were just so good, or add more appealing characters. And so they would feed certain answers to certain people or tell other ones to take a dive and just basically make them more entertaining. And when people found out about that, it was such a shock nationally that someone on television could lie to you. What an innocent time. I know, you know, that quiz shows went away for like 40 years until Merv Griffin came up with the idea of Jeopardy, which was, okay, if the whole idea of the quiz show scandals is we got caught for giving the answers to contestants, let's have a game where we give the answers to contestants and they've got to come up with the questions.
Scandal free right there.
Love it.
Yes, I don't know how that gets around it, but it worked.
Yeah, it seemed, but at least people bought the premise. We're getting a lot of emails from folks here on Studio 2 talking about their favorite game show memories. Patricia mentions her grandmother, who lived in the Olney section of Philadelphia, liked to watch Queen for a day on our black and white TV. Johnny loves Johnny loves The Price is Right, Bob Barker, and all that excitement. I would be glued to the giant buzzing tube TV at my house in Wallingford. And I wanted to build off that, David, and ask you a question about what makes a good host, because this is a quote from Bob Barker, actually in a column by your colleague Ken Tucker that he wrote for The Inquirer in 1988. But the quote from Bob Barker is, "I don't sing, I don't dance, I don't act, I don't tell jokes, and I'm not about to start now because I'm a star." What makes someone Bob Barker or Pat Sajak or Alex Trebek, having that star quality without really doing anything?
Well, you know, Drew Carey came on and became, after being an actual sitcom star, became a host and did it really well, surprisingly. You have to enjoy people. You have to pay attention to people, and you have to calm them down and make them shine. Jack Benny once said that when people asked him why he gave so many of the good lines on his sitcom to the people around him, he said, "Look, if I make people around me look good, that the people watching at home, all they're going to remember when they leave is that they had a good time when they're through watching." Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is the true thing of a host, too, is just you want to be here, you want to come back, want to put people at ease. Oh, but my God, Queen for a Day is one of the most mortifying shows in the history of television.
Give us a quick synopsis.
Cherry, do either of you know that show?
No,
I've never heard of it.
Okay, it's so long ago in the history of TV. It's way, way back there. But they had three different people. We would now not call them housewives, but that's what they were. And they would compete to tell the story of their life. And whoever was the most miserable, who had the worst life, would get to be crowned queen for a day and get a dozen roses and a crown and a hat and maybe a dishwasher.
Oh, my God.
You know,
a dishwasher.
And it's like, and so they had to tell what they wanted as a prize. Like my teenage son has cerebral palsy and I want to get him a new wheelchair. And so at the end, the studio audience applauds and the level of the applause meter decides who is queen for a day.
Oh, my goodness. So it's like a pity competition?
You can see these. You can see these. Yes. Yes, that's exactly what it is.
Oh, my God.
I'm telling you, anybody listening that thinks I'm making this up.
Look it up.
luckily, YouTube, you queen for a day. Oh, my.
And
wow.
And speaking of mortifying, because it seems like to tell your big pity story would be a little mortifying.
Yeah.
We want to play another clip from Wheel of Fortune. And it's just one of the many moments where the contestant just can't seem to get it right. Take a listen to this one.
I'll solve.
Okay.
another feather in your lap.
No. Laura, you have another opportunity here. You can spin the wheel. You can try to solve the puzzle. What do you want to do?
I will solve.
Okay.
Another feather in your map.
Christopher.
Of course, it's another feather in your gap.
And your gap. Yeah. Or how about we just make that up? And I have to say, yeah. I've never been that great at you know, these that types of quizzes. Yeah, yeah, but that would have been mortifying to me.
David, can I ask you, because we are talking about Wheel here, we did promise the folks to talk a little bit about the future of these properties. They've been incredibly sort of enduring, right? Jeopardy, Wheel, Price is Right, Family Feud has been on and off, but is still around. Do the next 40 years look as rosy as the last 40, or are we sort of in the fading years of the of this genre?
Well, in a word, no, because the reason why they've done so well for the last 10 or 20 years, particularly Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune, is because the government sort of stepped in at some point and said, hey, that hour between when there's national news, like the newscast, and then the start of primetime, can't be programmed by the networks anymore. And so it had to be done by local stations or by owned and operated things. And so game shows were turned out to be the perfect thing. But nobody watches television, or fewer people all the time watch television in real time the way you had to watch it a generation ago. Like, it's 7 o'clock, I've eaten dinner, I've seen the news, what am I going to watch just to relax? People don't do that as much. But the format will exist, and people are now capable of finding what they want when they want to see it. So I think it will exist into the future. What I'm fascinated by is not only did Ryan Seacrest get chosen to carry on the mantle in the U.S., but in the U.K., Wheel of Fortune is going to be hosted by Graham Norton, who is like my favorite talk show guy over there.
Those are two big names, which is an interesting way to pivot.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I wish we had more time to talk about
this, too.
Jerry. That is David Bianculli, TV critic and professor of television studies at Rowan University, and we'd love to have you back on another time, David. I really appreciate the time on Studio 2.
All right, this was so much fun. This was so much fun. Thank you, Cherry. Thank you, Avi.
Yes, and thank you to all the listeners who sent their memories and spoke to us today. So coming up, new music suggestions from the City of Brotherly Love and Sisterly Affection. Stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
We're going to be jamming.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg.
Talking some music now to round out the show on this Wednesday. Philly, of course, such an artsy and musical city.
Yes.
You must have some Philly artists in your playlist. Your favorites.
You know, because of streaming, I don't always know who the people are. And I feel really bad about that. Yeah. But
you have some that you know.
Yeah, for sure.
For sure. You got the Roots or something.
Jill Scott, of those folks. But, you know, I like to stay up and stay with the times. And I could use some help getting new tunes to add to the mix, which is why we have asked WHYY's Amir Richardson, a rapper and songwriter himself, to stop by with some suggestions. So by day, he is the community conversations convener for WHYY, but by night, he is known in Philly as the Bull Bay, a rapper, songwriter, And he comes in occasionally to introduce us to some local musicians we should check out. So we're happy to hear you, have you here, Amir.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, let's get right into it.
Yeah. Why not? Why not?
Because you got three great songs for us today. I'm going to set up the first one. This is by an artist named Chemist, and the song is Streets Don't Love You. Let's take a listen.
No, we don't have what we need for stomachs. I got an AK and a ski mask. That's what you need for money. I put a blade under his rib cage. That's how my shoes got bloody. Hands are forced every day here. What could you possibly tell me? I never believed in the us that they tried to sell me. So much as felt as your codes aren't caught as much as derailment. I'll show you illness, the ugly truth, raw and always unfiltered. I'm round some killers, and since the sandbox we just had to deal with.
Well, what are we hearing there, Amir? What do you like about this track?
Very, very vivid lyrics and storytelling. It's just very authentic. This is an artist who's from the Logan section of North Philadelphia. Philadelphia has so many different conversations happening all at once. There's social, economical things going on. And I feel like he just pulls at all those different things and kind of gives you a very, very clear message. And he doesn't forget the music and the writing, which is always so good. And so he has an album coming out next month. It's called A List of Demands. It's executive produced by DJ Jazzy
wow.
Jeff.
Former Studio 2 guest,
contestant.
By the way.
Right. I mean, I was like contestant. I know.
But we're a game
yes.
show mode. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a great segment, by the way.
Thank you.
But yeah, I mean, I always enjoyed his writing. And he has a background in spoken word.
Yes.
I find that very interesting. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, spoken word has a long-standing history in the city of Philadelphia. Writing, literature, all these different things has a long-standing history in Philadelphia. And it's always been interesting to watch people try to make that leap between, like, hey, I have this slam poem, and I'm going to put sonics around it and create this experience. And sometimes it's good, and sometimes... But Chemist is absolutely someone who kind of, like, evolved his writing into becoming like an incredible songwriter, a guitarist. He's won multiple songwriting competitions,
wow.
A John Lennon songwriting competition.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, this is someone who is right here in the city just doing stellar, incredible work. You know, me as a songwriter, I'm often inspired by what he's doing and, you know, the community that he's cultivating of just reading and writing. He collaborates a lot with the Harriet Bookshop here in Philadelphia.
Yeah, love. Yeah,
yeah,
love
great,
him.
Great,
Janine
guy,
Cook,
great guy.
Yes,
yeah.
And he can sing.
Yeah, which
because
is
that,
news
yes,
to me.
It was. I was like, is that him? He has a beautiful voice.
Yeah, yeah. He has a beautiful voice. He has a beautiful perspective, and you know, I really appreciate the fact that he's been adamant about writing. You know, songwriting is it's a great big
yeah.
world of songwriting, but he focuses in on being lyrical and vivid.
And so I want to move on now to our next artist, Julia Pratt, and the song is All I'm Missing.
Jeez. I heard it once, twice, and one ear then out. Gotta make your mind beyond the shadow of doubt.
Now, Amir, my shoulders are bopping.
Come on now.
So upbeat. Please tell us about Julia and what drew you to her sound.
Yeah, I mean, I'll cut straight to the chase. She is a fresh new voice here in Philadelphia. And, you know, Philadelphia has this long, rich tapestry of arts, history, music, so on and so on. But she is new, very
yeah.
new. And, you know, born and raised in the city, cut her teeth. You know, she's just so young. And fresh. And so it's really incredible to see what she's doing at an early age. She's opened up for artists like Hozier. And you can catch her at World Cafe Live June 30th. She's just doing incredible
oh, wow.
things.
Yeah. Wow. And upbeat sound, at least on that track. I liked the horns in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I could imagine that like in a top 40 format. Like I could see that in the radio play world.
Absolutely. She has the capability to float in and out of pop, float in and out of R&B, float in and out of blues, bluegrass. She's just so very dynamic. And she also has like a nice little falsetto that you have
Ooh.
To hear live. You have to hear it live.
How did you hear her live?
You know, I'm very much an artist myself, right? So I run around and I go to shows and open mics and writing sessions and mixers and so on and so on. And I was lucky enough to meet her At a Grammy mixer. You know, Philadelphia has a Grammy chapter here in the city, and so they hold a lot of events where people can meet face-to-face and say, hello, my name is such and such.
I had no idea that existed.
I'll invite you next time.
Oh, okay.
American.
We're taking it outside
Love
studio,
it.
Too. Yeah. One more we want to get in before we wrap. This is a song called Drummer by the artist Sun Little. Take it away, Charlie.
You could be giving the drummer some.
So my understanding, Amir, is that Sun Little, compared to Julia Pratt and Chemist, more of a track record, a little more established on the scene. Is that right?
Absolutely. Has collaborated with Mavis Staples, a gospel activist. Has collaborated with so many different artists throughout the city and worldwide. This person tours actively. Right now is on a tour. Will be in Australia later in the year. You know, this is someone who's from the city, who, you know, collaborates often within the city, but leaves and shares the art and shares Philadelphia's story worldwide. And so I really appreciate Sun Little, what he does. I feel like he's a walking museum of songwriting and music.
And you mentioned, is he a drummer?
Yes, the name of the song. He has his
the
recent album that he put out, and that is the first song on the album.
It's so good. It's so good. And so we have to share your other recommendations as well, because I mean, these are so wonderful. And by the way, Sun Little sounds very soulful to me.
Absolutely. Philadelphia continues to, I guess, cement itself in soul music and continues to contribute. And, you know, we all listen to Jill Scott and the Roots and Bilal. And you know, they will never be taken off of the Mount
rotation.
Rushmore that they're on. But I really appreciate the fact that Philadelphia has such diverse contributions of soul and raspiness and bounce and groove, and you know, as soon as the song hits, you're moving, you're grooving. So it's great. I love it.
And we were moving and grooving here in the studio. We were
and we have to have you back, Amir, every
Absolutely.
So often, because I like to feel like I'm in the know, and with these recommendations I know I'm gonna be on a rabbit hole.
I got you.
And by the way, we're going to link to Amir's recommendations on our webpage, whyy.org/studio2, if you want to know the spellings, the song titles, so you can follow up and put them on your playlist. We're going to tweet them, too, so make sure to follow WHYY on Twitter. Again, the songs we played today were Chemist, Streets Don't Love You, Julia Pratt, All I'm Missing, and Sun Little, Drummer. That is Amir Richardson, a.k.a. The Bull Bay. Thanks so much for joining us, Amir.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
And that is it for our show today. We welcome you back tomorrow for another hour of Studio 2. Our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Murray-Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. And from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Thank you for joining us today.